Welcome to Yale Cancer Center Answers with Drs. Ed Chu and Ken Miller. I'm Bruce Barber. Dr. Chu is Deputy Director and Chief of Medical Oncology at Yale Cancer Center and an internationally recognized expert on colorectal cancer. Dr. Miller is the Director of the Connecticut Challenge Survivorship Program, and he's also the author of Choices in Breast Cancer Treatment. If you'd like to join the discussion, you can contact the doctors directly. The address is canceranswers@yale.edu, and the phone number is 1-888-234-4YCC. This evening, Ed and Ken welcome Drs. Richard Peschel and John Kohlberg. Dr. Peschel is a professor of therapeutic radiology, and Dr. Kohlberg is an associate professor of surgery, both at Yale School of Medicine.
John, why don't we go ahead and start off by maybe defining the population of males who are at the highest risk, increased risk for developing prostate cancer?
Well, certainly any man over the age 50 is considered a risk for prostate cancer. Certainly there's some specific risk factors you look for. Family history, meaning one or more first-degree relatives, father, brother, uncles that have prostate cancer. You also look at, race. We know that African-American men have a higher incidence of prostate cancer and have more aggressive disease at diagnosis. And finally, age. The older you become, the greater risk you'll have prostate cancer.
Now, unfortunately for all of us males, there's always the risk for developing benign prostate diseases. And so if a male were to develop a benign prostate disease disorder, does that place that individual at increased risk for developing prostate cancer?
No, it doesn't appear to that way. The problem is it develops in the same group of men. The same men who develop benign enlargement, or BPH, also are at risk of developing prostate cancer, but benign disease does not confer an increased risk of prostate cancer.
Now, I have to say, I've heard a wide variety of estimates, but so maybe we can clarify it. But if we live long enough, I mean, if a man lives to age 70, 80, 90, what's the chance of – I have two questions. Number one, that there is some cancer in the prostate. And number two, that it really would cause him trouble.
Well, those are certainly two different questions. But if you look at even autopsy specimens, which we base that on, is that you can have prostate cancer as young as age 30. And if you look at men who are in the 80s and 90s, probably 70, maybe 80% of men will have a small focus of prostate cancer that is probably not significant. And there's lots of different definitions of insignificant prostate cancers, volume, Gleason's grades and scores, et cetera. But yes, I think the older you become, the greater chance you have prostate cancer. And that number is probably, if you live long enough, maybe up to 100%.
Now, just curious, if prostate cancer were to hit someone at the age of 30, 35, would you automatically assume that that cancer is going to be more aggressive than, say, if it were to affect someone who's 75, 80 years of age?
I think that's safe to say. I think that the younger you are, the more concerning it is. Not to say that people in their 70s don't get aggressive cancer, because they do. But certainly you have a lot more years to live when you're 35 or 40. Again, it's pretty uncommon. I mean, I will see a handful of men in their 40s a year that have prostate cancer. So it's not a real common entity because we don't look for it. We don't draw PSAs or blood samples routinely on men in their 30s and 40s unless we have a specific reason.
I think the key to answering your question is we do have a marker for aggressiveness, and that's the Gleason score. What does the cancer look like in the microscope? So independent of age, you have a pretty good estimate of how aggressive the cancer is going to be based on the Gleason score.
Richard, let me ask you in terms of screening. So, you know, what are your recommendations and your thoughts in terms of what's good screening and at what age? And
I think for the average American male, screening should begin at about 50, should include a PSA, a rectal examination, and probably once a year. I think there are subgroups of patients that should be screened earlier, strong family history. African-American males, for instance, probably should be screened earlier.
And what PSA number does one need to begin to worry about? I know a lot of my male friends who go to the doctors, get the PSA, you know, they're really obsessed with what the number that comes back. So what do each of you kind of tend to think about in terms of the number that one needs to be worried?
Well, historically, the number has always been less than 4. And I think that's probably not appropriate, especially the younger you are. I think there's what we call age reference PSA levels that one looks at. But more importantly, I think, is what happens to the number over time. So, for example, if you come in and your PSA is 2, certainly that's within the normal range. But it's more importantly what happens over time. So if that number jumps up to 3 or 4 over a year's period of time, even though it may be normal, that's kind of a red flag that something probably should be investigated. But it's a little bit of a gray area as far as what is a normal PSA level. Certainly under 4, the younger you are, the lower the number is. So if I see a man who's 45 in my office and his PSA is 3.5, that's probably too high. But if I see an 80-year-old man or 75-year-old man in my office and his PSA is 4.1, that's probably okay.
I think the other thing we're learning, particularly with the epidemic of obesity in this country, is that the PSA has to be corrected for weight.
Oh, interesting.
And significantly obese men have artificially low PSAs, and you have to make some adjustment for that.
Hmm. Wow, I have to say that's a new data,
but it's very interesting and discouraging, to be honest with you, because of the outbreak of obesity that's coming.
Hmm. Let's get back to this issue, if you would, of genetics and hereditariness inherited risk. Do we have any idea why, what the mechanism is? Is there a gene that we've identified?
I don't think we know the cause of prostate cancer. Certainly, there seems to be environmental factors that are very important. There are some identified genes in the African-American population. For instance, about 10% of African-Americans have an identifiable genetic mutation that puts them at risk for higher and more advanced prostate cancer. In our department, we're studying DNA, a nick in the DNA that can be identified and associated with prostate cancer and higher failure rates. So we're looking. I think we haven't found the full answer yet. Hmm.
And I think most prostate cancers are sporadic, just like colon cancer, or breast cancer, or kidney cancer. There is a genetic component and a small portion of it. Most of them are sporadic. They have no family history or family history that's significant.
And what are some of the typical symptoms that an individual might experience?
Well, I think most patients don't have any symptoms. The main reason why they've come to the office and they've been biopsied or have diagnosed with prostate cancer because they've had an elevated PSA level. And occasionally they'll have some BPH symptoms like we just described earlier, slowing of the stream, getting up at night. But those aren't specific for prostate cancer. It's pretty uncommon nowadays to see people come in with symptoms of metastatic disease or advanced disease like bone pain, pelvic pain, urinary retention, things like that, which you used to see 20 or 30 or 40 years ago. You don't see that very often. So most men have no symptoms with their low-grade or localized prostate cancer, early prostate cancer.
Yeah, I agree with that. I think most men have symptoms because they have benign prostatic hypertrophy, and that's what brings them to the urologist. Almost nobody has a symptom anymore from prostate cancer because of PSA screening.
Mm-hmm. You know, when we talk about cancer in general, I mean, people are scared. They say, yeah, I think it's one of the reasons people, you know, men, women don't do the tests that perhaps they should have done. But, you know, if you are suspicious as a clinician that someone may have prostate cancer, how do you make the diagnosis? Is that a big operation? Is that something for people to fear and avoid?
Well, I think, like I said, people usually come in with an elevated PSA level or an examination with your finger. When you feel the man's prostate, there's a lump or a nodule or there's a firmness. And the way you make the diagnosis is with a biopsy. And those are done in the office. They're called transrectal, meaning we put an ultrasound probe in the rectum and we take the biopsy to the rectal wall under local anesthesia, and it's an office procedure. It's very well tolerated. It's not painless, but it's uncomfortable, but it's well tolerated. And, you know, usually we have the answer in 48 to 72 hours when the pathologist looks at the slides.
And then once the diagnosis of prostate cancer is made, what goes into the decision-making process as to what treatments should be recommended to that individual?
Well, there's a very wide spectrum of choices that patients face. You look at their general health, comorbidities, their age. Their Gleason score is particularly important. The PSA, which is the blood test, and then their physical exam. And so the choices that you can lay before them go all the way from observation, careful observation without treatment, surgery, radiation therapy. So wide choice, but it's all based on general health, PSA, Gleason score, and age.
And I think the thing of it is that there's no one cookbook answer for every patient. I try to emphasize that with my patients, that a decision that's right for you may not be that the same for someone else, so that someone may be a very good candidate for surgery and other person may be a better candidate for radiation therapy, and there's no right answer. There may be better answers, but there's no absolute right answer for each patient.
I think we're going to have an opportunity to get into some depth about the treatment that both of you have to offer to patients. But let me ask about a different group. Who are men where you could consider watchful waiting?
Well, a typical patient that we would think about watchful waiting would be an elderly patient, perhaps in their late 70s. A patient with severe medical problems, heart disease, lung disease, kidney disease, life expectancy less than 10 years, for example, they would be good observation patients. Patients with low Gleason scores, the scoring system goes from 2 to 10. If you see a patient with a Gleason 5 or 6, we usually would discuss observation with that particular patient. So it's kind of like you know them when you see them, mm-hmm. and observation is a perfectly good option for many of the patients that we see.
And there's even growing evidence, and people are trying to define someone who has maybe low volume, very localized disease, and that's the hard part. And even younger men could be considered for that protocol. But it's a very intense protocol, meaning they follow up, four times a year with PSA levels, rectal examinations. They get repeat biopsies at a year or 18 months. So you want to make sure that they actually have low volume disease. And you're maybe not saying they're never going to be treated, but you may be able to delay that treatment so that 6 months or a year or 2 or 3 years down the road, they may be able to be treated at that time as opposed to immediately. But it's a very, very tricky dilemma to propose.
Yeah, there's some risk involved. The needle biopsy, which is what you're trying to make a decision on, is about 10 to 15% inaccurate. There could be a higher grade tumor hiding somewhere that the biopsy didn't see. Secondly, the tumor can transform itself from a very low grade to a higher grade after 2, 3, or 4 years. So many patients need to have repeat biopsies to kind of keep track of that.
Is there ever a role for, imaging of the local prostate disease, such as with CAT scan or MRI? You typically don't use that as part of the evaluation process.
Well, if you look at men who have PSAs under 10, and Gleason scores of less than 8, the yield of bone scans and CAT scans and MRIs are pretty low. I think the way I use, for example, endorectal MRIs or MRIs is to look at the local disease. So if someone's kind of on the border, maybe you'd be a good surgical candidate, but you're not certain. Maybe there's disease outside the prostate gland. Maybe their PSA is 15 and they've got a Gleason 8. Sometimes an MRI will kind of make the difference to maybe suggesting he have surgery versus having radiation therapy.
I think the role of other diagnostic tests is less important because the PSA is such a good screening tool. You're really picking patients up who have very early disease, microscopic disease, and generally CT scan or MRI scan aren't all that useful for the average patient. It's very important for a patient between choosing surgery or radiation, but not so important in terms of staging.
I think the next 5 to 10 years, they're going to come up with better imaging, spectroscopy, ways to kind of really identify small volume or microscopic disease within the gland that you could maybe do some focal therapy with or find that person who has really low volume disease that you'll want to follow, but we're not quite there yet.
Yeah, actually, I want to follow up on that. In breast cancer, we're now, we went from radical mastectomy to modified radical and now to lumpectomy, and even the idea of just very localized radiation to a part of the breast. Do you see that happening in prostate cancer?
I think it'll happen. It's just that we don't, like we talked about, we don't have the imaging technology or the capabilities yet. Plus, prostate cancer tends to be a multifocal disease, so that even if you have biopsies on one side or one particular area on the biopsy, when you do the prostate and take it out, the disease will be in several areas of the prostate. So it's a very tricky proposition, but that's where we're headed.
Yeah. I agree with that. When I started treating prostate cancer 30 years ago, the vast majority of patients had disease outside the prostate at diagnosis. So it had already spread before treatment. Now, probably 90% or more of the patients have the disease confined to the prostate. This has been this huge stage migration. And I think the next step, I agree with John, MRI spectroscopy can now plot the three-dimensional distribution of the tumor inside the prostate, and it should be possible to use even more focal treatment rather than just treating the entire prostate.
Yeah. I'm saying actually very, very exciting. We're going to take a break now for a medical minute, and then we'll be back with Dr. Richard Peschel and Dr. John Kohlberg from the Yale Cancer Center talking about prostate cancer.
Over 170,000 Americans will be diagnosed with lung cancer this year, and more than 85% of these diagnoses are related to smoking. The important thing to understand is that quitting, even after decades of use, can significantly reduce your risk of developing lung cancer. Now, everyday patients with lung cancer are surviving thanks to increased access to advanced therapies and specialized care, and new treatment options are giving lung cancer survivors new hope. Clinical trials are currently underway at federally designated comprehensive cancer centers, like the one at Yale, to test innovative new treatments for lung cancer, and patients enrolled in these trials are given access to medicines not yet approved by the Food and Drug Administration. This has been a Medical Minute, and you'll find more information at yalecancercenter.org. You're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.
Welcome back to Yale Cancer Center Answers. This is Dr. Ken Miller, and I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Ed Chu, and our guest, Dr. John Kohlberg, and Dr. Richard Peschel, who are experts in the treatment of prostate cancer. So let me ask you this. A patient's diagnosed with prostate cancer. Who's on the multidisciplinary team, and how do you use that team approach?
We really work very well together as a team. And John and I have developed a philosophy over time that we're very, very comfortable with in terms of who gets surgery, who gets radiation. And Kevin Kelly in medical oncology is also part of that team. We have a conference that meets twice a month to discuss difficult patients. So there's a large, wide spectrum of expertise that's involved in making patients make a decision, helping them.
Because oftentimes these patients, even though they may have surgery or they may have radiation therapy, oftentimes they may need other things. They may need radiation therapy after their surgery, or they may need hormonal therapy, and so that it's more of a multidisciplinary approach to all these cancers, not only prostate but all other GU cancers.
You know, as you were saying earlier, John, the decision to, I guess, undergo a certain treatment really is kind of very individualized. And, you know, I know all of us have friends and colleagues who've had, you know, early stage prostate cancer, have kind of gone through the anxiety of trying to determine whether or not they should undergo surgery versus radiation therapy. So maybe you can kind of each take us through kind of the pros and cons, advantages, disadvantages, kind of from your own vantage point. Maybe, John, you can start off with.
Well, I think that you know, certainly I do the surgery, but I'm fairly open about it, and I try to give the patients all the options, and I think that in general terms, we operate in younger, more healthy patients. Now, that doesn't mean we don't operate in 70-year-old men. We do. But in general terms, I think that's the first thing you look at. Then you look at the stage of disease. You want to operate on localized prostate cancer, people who don't have disease outside the prostate, and that's based on patient examination, the patient's PSA level, and the pathology of the Gleason score, which we've talked about several times. And then ultimately, I think my role is that I try to give the patient as much information as they can. And a lot of them, they come in with an idea what they want to have done, and they're just kind of confirming or determining if that's the person they want to take care of. But oftentimes, we'll send patients back and forth with Dr. Peschel and myself. You know, I'll have a patient who I think is probably a surgical person, but just to circle the wagons and make sure he's comfortable with everything, I'll send him to Dr. Peschel, and he'll talk with him about radiation therapy.
Now, I guess, obviously, a big concern that either is or is not discussed, but clearly I think it becomes on the forefront of a lot of males, is this issue of sexual function after surgery and high risk of impotence, potential risk of impotence.
I think there are two big downsides of surgery, and for radiation therapy, one of them too is loss of sexual function or erectile dysfunction, and incontinence, the inability to control your urine after the operation, and those are very, very concerning issues, because now, not that they can't be handled if you develop those after surgery, but certainly that's a big concern of all the patients. And if you look at surgery, in someone who does a safe number of radical prostatectomies a year, that you're talking about an incidence of incontinence of anywhere from 3 to 5%. Erectile dysfunction or sexual dysfunction is based on two things: the age of the patient and what their status is before the operation. So all comers, if you have a 50-year-old man who has good erections before the operations, your success rate with surgery, if you do nerve sparing, is probably somewhere between 70 to 80%. If you're 70 years old and you have fair erections, it's probably more like 10 or 20%.
I want to ask the same thing with radiation, because I think, you know, these are the issues that men are going to be asking about. So if you treat a man with radiation, and you know, same issue, 50-year-old man, 70-year-old man.
Yeah. The question with radiation therapy is most of our patients who have more advanced disease, higher grade, also receive hormone therapy. And the combination of hormone therapy and radiation therapy produces more erectile dysfunction than if they just had radiation therapy alone. So those that just get radiation, erectile dysfunction is about 20 to 30%, very similar to surgery. But we need to use hormones in many, many patients, and the impotence rate climbs to about 50%.
It's interesting, because I think the general misconception is that with radiation therapy, there is no risk for developing erectile dysfunction.
Yeah, there are a couple of components to that. One, I mentioned the use of hormone therapy definitely adds to erectile dysfunction. And then secondly, our age group is older. Our average patient is about 70 to 78 years old. Surgical patients tend to be younger, so they have fewer age factors in terms of whether they'll be potent or not.
And I think with surgery that people won't immediately be potent after the operation. It may take 6 months, may take 12 months, may take 18 months to actually recover their sexual function.
Yeah. And I think, to be honest with you, the data documenting potency sparing is very poor. It's very soft data. There aren't any really good studies. So when we talk about these numbers, they're very soft
numbers. Now, Dick, have the complications secondary to radiation therapy improved now that you're developing more sophisticated, focused approaches to deliver the radiation therapy to patients?
Yeah, the complication rates have just fallen dramatically. This intensity modulated radiation therapy, which we've used at Yale for over 10 years, has produced complication rates the lowest we've ever seen. All other types of radiation therapy that were used in the past for prostate cancer produced 6% to 15% complications that affected quality of life. With IMRT, based on 800 patients that we've treated, it's down to less than 1%. We've just never seen anything like it. And now we're moving into what's called image-guided intensity-modulated radiation therapy, which should allow us to escalate the dose more but maintain these very low complication rates.
You know, since we're talking about radiation, can you tell us a little bit about seed implants? So what are they, and who should receive that treatment?
Well, we used to do a lot of seed implants. I've done 500 myself. It's the placement of little tiny radioactive seeds into the prostate in sort of a set distribution to produce a minimum dose to the outside of the prostate. There are two different isotopes that are used. One is iodine-125. And the other is palladium-103. We've tended to use palladium here at Yale because of the lower or shorter half-life. In an amazing way, we've sort of set aside a prostate implant at Yale because our intensity-modulated radiation therapy results are so good. The complication rate is one-tenth that of implant, and the cure rates look better than with implants. So we've tended to emphasize in our patient population intensity-modulated radiation therapy.
John, as we've been just talking about the advances in radiation therapy, there also have been, I think, some pretty significant advances in surgical techniques.
Yeah, I think that the most recent advance is the idea of minimally invasive prostatectomy using a system called the Da Vinci system, which is a robotic-type system. Been around probably since the early 2001, 2002. In that time, there's probably about 400 prostates done that way. In the United States now, probably 50% of all prostatectomies are done robotically, and probably the next 5 years, probably 80 or 90% will be done all robotically. And what the system is that it operates through small little punctures in the lower abdomen. In fact, you make about six little holes in the abdomen, and through these little holes, you have a camera and working ports where you're actually able to operate this robot from remotely across the room and actually do the same operation. The advantages are several. One, less blood loss, less time in the hospital, less pain, less time with a Foley catheter. As far as the important things of prostatectomy is cancer control seems to be equivalent to open operation. Potency may be a little bit better, and you may get it, the return of erectile your erections back sooner with a robotic prostatectomy. And incontinence may be is about the same at a year, but may also get control a little bit sooner. So I would say that we've had the machine, the robotic system at Yale for about 2+ years, and I would say 95% of our patients have robotic prostatectomies. There's always a rare instance where you need to still do an open procedure, and there's always a risk when you do robotic prostatectomies that it may need to be converted to an open operation because it can't be done robotically. But it's very exciting.
Hmm. Actually, I want to ask you, John, because you've done both kinds of procedures. Just for you as a surgeon, what's it like being on the other side of the room?
Well, I mean, certainly there is a learning curve to the procedure. It's not a huge learning curve for someone who's done a lot of open operations or are very adept at laparoscopic skills, but it's a different operation. It's much better visualization. You see things that you probably didn't see before. You're more exact the way you dissect things, dissect the nerves, preserve the sphincter for the urethra. So I think that it's a very good operation, and I think it's definitely here to stay.
And is this robotic surgery just for prostate cancer, or potentially could be applied for surgical resection of other tumors?
I think for certainly they use it for a lot of different tumors. They can do it for a pediatric population, for pyeloplasties, meaning obstructions of the kidney. People have done them for partial nephrectomies, radical nephrectomies. General surgery's done it for distal pancreatectomies, colon sections. Thoracic uses it. Cardiovascular use it for mitral valve repairs. Urology will use it eventually, and people are already doing it to remove bladders for radical cystoprostatectomies. So I think that it's just beginning to kind of take off as far as what it can be used for.
The good news about this procedure is that John has appropriately advanced the age where patients can have surgery when they're older now. The average age of patients having surgery used to be 58, and I think John pushes that up to 68 or 69 now. So it gives older patients the opportunity to think about the surgical option.
A clinical question, but and I think this may be a real one. I mean, a man comes to you who's 50 years old, let's say with a PSA that's 3 or 4, an intermediate Gleason's grade. I'm really trying to paint not a high risk and not a low risk patient, and says to you, doctors, what's better? Should I have radiation or should I have surgery? I mean, is there – how do you answer that?
We really have developed a philosophy at Yale that the younger patient should be offered surgery. And the reason for that is an average 50-year-old will live 25 years easily. And you need to look at the long-term data. And the long-term data for surgery is more robust. It's better defined. So we really emphasize surgery in the very young patient.
Curious, is there ever any role after surgery for additional radiation therapy plus or minus hormonal therapy?
I think that's a very great question, and that comes up a lot of patients. I think with PSA, it tempers it a little bit, because if you have a prostatectomy and your PSA becomes undetectable or zero, there is no evidence of disease. The question is, I think there's two questions, is what happens to the man who the PSA starts to go up after surgery? And that gets to be a very difficult dilemma, because there's certain parameters you want to look at. When did the PSA level go up? What did the original pathology show? And maybe Dick can describe what our kind of our philosophy is of who we radiate.
Yeah, there are two programs. One is called adjuvant radiation therapy. If you see poor pathologic findings at surgery, you immediately treat the patient with post-op radiation therapy. And the other is called salvage radiation therapy, where you wait for the patient's PSA to become detectable and then treat with post-op radiation therapy. They're two very different approaches.
Great. Well, you've been listening to Yale Cancer Center Answers, and we'd like to thank our guest experts, Drs. John Kohlberg and Richard Peschel, for joining us, and we look forward to having you back on a future show. Until next time, this is Ed Chu from the Yale Cancer Center wishing you a safe and healthy week.
If you have any questions for the doctors or would like to share your comments, go to yalecancercenter.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and find written transcripts of past programs. Next week, Dr. Peter Marks joins us to discuss leukemia. I'm Bruce Barber, and you're listening to the WNPR Health Forum from Connecticut Public Radio.